Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
My guest today, a guy that we love having on this show. I love having on this show. He's hard to get because his schedule is crazy. But when we can get him, we grab on and we say, let's line up a couple hours for a Friday evening. He is the co-host of the Hammer Down show on Cable 14. For maybe, I don't know, I want to say probably, maybe more famous as the voice of the Hamilton Ticats in stadium at Tim Hortons Field. When the game is on, it's his voice that you hear announcing first downs and get loud and all that kind of stuff. His name is Mike Nabors. Joins me now. Mike, how are you?
I am fantastic, Scott. Thank you so much for having me on the show. And yeah, I'm excited. I love spending a Friday night hanging out with you and talking about everything.
You know, before we get going, I've had a question that I've been wanting to ask you for quite a while, because when people hear your name, I'm sure they think that your last name is spelled Nabors, like neighborhood, like Mr. Rogers' neighbor. It's not.
Yes,
it's
they do.
N-A-B-U-U-R-S. I don't know any other name with back-to-back U's. What nationality is Nabors?
It's Dutch.
Okay.
And it's actually the pronunciation in the Netherlands would be Nabors. And so my family Canadianized it a little bit. My favorite story to tell, Scott, about the two U's. So N-A-B-U-U-R-S. And I used to say to people, you know, two U's like in vacuum. And people would say, vacuum has two U's?
I thought it was V-A-K-O-O-M.
I know. So anyway, yeah, it's a Dutch name. And it technically, the funniest part to me is, it actually, in Dutch, it means neighbor.
Well, that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? So I said, who named us? The guy next door? Like, what happened? Remember, you used to, in the old days, right? You'd be the blacksmith, so they were the blacks. And
the Smiths, I mean, they were the butchers.
Yeah, the Smiths. Whatever. Whatever it was. And I said, I guess we just got named by the people next door because we're the neighbors.
But when you were growing up, how many people got that name? Because I always find this amazing when people have names that are unusual a little bit, that they never, nobody ever spells their name right.
No, nobody would ever just out of the gate spell that name correctly. And it's also funny how many versions of the actual word neighbors you get. A lot of people have trouble spelling that word.
What, the English version?
The English version, you get the N-E-I-G-H-B-O-U-R-S, but then you also get the N-A-B-O-R-S, and you get the N-E-I-H-B. Like, people forget letters in it. I mean, you know what, neighbors itself, the English version of it, not the easiest word in the world to spell. So, yeah, we get lots of different things, but nobody's ever guessed the two U's without being told.
See, I'm glad that I'm not the only one, because I'll probably not... To anyone's surprise, the name I get all the time is Bradley. All the time.
Right,
I get
right,
Bradley.
Right.
And so I just, with a lot of people, have just literally got to the point where they look at me. So I say, Radley, like, let's say you go pick something up. It's an order and I have to find it under the R's. And I just go Bradley, or like Radley. It's Bradley without the B.
Yeah.
And then it's
exactly.
Like, oh, okay. Cause I get Radley, I get Ridley, I get Rodley. I think I still have bills that are under Rudley. And it's like, I just haven't even bothered to change it at this point. Well, who cares?
Yeah, you know what, it is funny. I got a lot of people would hear neighbors when I was introduced to them. I'd be Mike Nabors, and they would hear the neighbors, and then they'd call me Jim for the rest of the night. So I got that all the time.
Well, golly,
exactly. Yeah. And which as a reference today, maybe not, yeah, people wouldn't pick up on it as much, but certainly back, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, I mean, he was very, very well-known, very popular actor and singer. It's funny because working with Jason Farr on our show Hammer Down, Jason used to get Jamie all the time. Jamie Farr from MASH.
Yeah, well, so first of all, after doing my very horrendous Jim Nabors impression there,
yes,
I'm actually a little bit concerned that I instantly knew who that was, because I'm having a feeling this is really aging me. That if you know Jim Nabors, you can't be under what, 45 minimum?
No. No, he other than if, unless you're a huge car racing fan, because he would, up until the time of his passing, he would always sing right before the Indianapolis 500, right? He would sing At Home in Indianapolis or whatever that song is. And so he was still doing that right up until, you know, the mid-2000s. But other than a racing fan, you know, most people would not have remembered who Jim Nabors was. So.
I've started to realize, Mike, how our pop culture references betray our age. One of the producers who was on handling this show, or one of the other ones I was doing a while back, I made a mention for some reference that had come up of Tiny Tim. Okay. And they looked at me with four eyes, or absolutely, six eyes, or eight, like, what are you talking about? And then I think they had the thought of, wait, are you talking about A Christmas Carol? And it's like, no, it's the other guy who was tiptoeing through the tulips. And then once again, it's like, how old am I that I know this stuff?
Or the donuts, right? The Tiny Tim donuts, aren't
that? Yeah.
But yes, you're right. And it's funny, I find, and you and I both like to crack jokes. And when you start working, especially as you start to work with younger people, some of the jokes just aren't landing because they're like, well, I'm sorry, I don't know anything about Hogan's Heroes.
Yeah.
What is right. that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know what? Hogan's Heroes is a great one because we were referencing that some time ago. And I said, who in TV would green light a show like Hogan's Heroes today?
Absolutely.
Where the stars of this sitcom, it's a comedy, are Nazi prison camp guards.
I know.
And you're like, this is just, but again, like glassed over, like Hogan's what?
Oh, yeah.
Just go watch CHGH between about 4 o'clock and 6 o'clock. And it's probably right. on there, the old timer show.
It's still on there.
Yeah, you might catch up. You learn some history.
And you could certainly, Gilligan's Island, okay, you can understand, sort of where that would come from. Okay, we're putting together a comedy and okay, they're stranded on an island. But the thought behind Hogan's Heroes was like, wow, that is really left field stuff, man.
I can't even imagine someone going in and pitching that. If you went into a pitch meeting with that today, you would be blacklisted from Hollywood forever. We're gonna have a hilarious show about the Nazis and they're the jokesters. Okay. Thanks very much. You see, email blast to everyone in Hollywood. Do not hire this person. Do not take a meeting.
That's right.
Mike, I want to get into something first because this week it was supposed to happen. There was a police board meeting on Thursday here in Hamilton and it got put off. The topic got put off. It got deferred. But one of the topic they were talking about was the idea of equipping all of our officers in the city with body cams so that what the officers do is videotaped and the powers that be can see the interactions. If there are complaints against the officer for his or her behavior, we can see that right away. If the person who the police pull over or stop is doing something, we can see that right away. I'm not sure this is a controversial issue anymore, but for the $15 million price tag, which is a lot of money. But are you on board with the idea of equipping cops with these things?
100%. Even at 15 mil. I don't think, in this day and age, and Scott, I gotta tell you, man, my TikTok algorithm is chock-a-block full of police video. and I watch a lot of these videos of police interactions with people and the thing I think to myself all the time, I think, man, I wish more people could see what the police have to put up with when they are dealing with the public. And a lot of them are American, and I know, things can get a little rougher there, but it's the same thing. I think for each police officer's own protection, that having that camera, and also, in all honesty, to keep them thinking, hey, this is all being recorded. I mean, I don't know that anybody loses in this situation because then we have evidence of what happened and there isn't a he said, she said after the fact about what really went down that time.
Agreed. And the other thing that it does, and we were talking about this, I was filling in yesterday on Scott Thompson's show, and we were talking about this. The other thing it does, it gives context because the camera is rolling for more. Like these days, and you talk about it, it's on your social video feed or social media feed, you will get video, but generally no one starts recording a police interaction that's going on until something bad is happening, until it gets heated.
Right.
So you don't have any of the context of what led up to this or what's been going on. Yes. Presumably this would provide for that. So if all of a sudden there's a police shooting, heaven forbid, we see why things got to where they were, whether it was a good shooting or whether it was a bad shooting, we get the whole picture, not a 5-second snapshot in the middle of nothing.
Yeah. And it gives, it gives everybody the evidence of what really happened without anybody being able to spin it. And it gives prosecutors and it gives defense lawyers, everybody's playing on the same playing field. And so we have the evidence of what went down, and then we can determine who was at fault, who was committing something illegal, who wasn't, whether the officer conducted themselves accordingly. I mean, all of those things, instead of afterwards, you get a situation where, you know, it's whoever can yell loudest at the media, which side gets spun. I think of this case in Toronto that they just went through with the gentleman who, you know, ran over the police officer. And I couldn't help but think that if those plainclothes officers, you know, if that was all videotaped, we there wouldn't have been 2 years of people saying the guy was guilty and then a jury finding him not guilty. And I mean, a lot of that would have been sorted out ahead of time.
And we wouldn't, and I know, I get your point. I mean, we wouldn't have had it in that case because plainclothes wouldn't be wearing one of these. But I get your point. Think of the example. What was the one that was very notorious in Toronto a few years ago with the shooting on the streetcar? That's probably even a more exact example.
Exactly.
A uniformed officer would have been wearing one. You would have seen exactly what was going on. Here's the one caveat, though, that I would throw out there. And this was raised by, again, my guest yesterday, and I hadn't thought of it, but I think it's a very valid point. If we're going to do this, I think what we have to do is make the videotapes accessible to people. Because if the police video these things, but then the public is never able to see the video because of privacy rules or whatever else, I think you do more to then create suspicion, because what are they hiding? You almost, if you're going to do this, you almost have to do it with an agreement that anyone who requests this, we're going to make it available.
Yes. And you know, I mean, you get as, I totally understand that there'd be some trepidation about that, because I mean, some people are being videotaped at their most fragile, most vulnerable moments. If the police are interacting with you, it's probably not a good day. But at the same time, I think that the transparency, and it's the only avenue I can think of where we can start to put away some of this bias. We can start to, you know, both the police, you know, sort of all gathering around in their own, it's like kind of like us against them, and we're the them. And so the police all sort of all support each other. But then also the bias on the other side that, you know, the police are evil and they're doing all these horrible things. It's like, well, let's go to the videotape.
Yeah.
Let's just see how horrible it was.
We do this, and I know it's not the same thing, but we do it in sports constantly now. We have instant replay in sports because for the longest time we had officials and we had players, and you had to rely on the officials, and sometimes you would see that they were wrong. Now you have instant replay, you go to the videotape, and you make the decision of who was right, who was wrong.
Yeah, yeah. And I know there's probably lots of officials who, you know, wish there wasn't some, you know, a camera second-guessing them, but at the same time, you know, we're trying to do our best to execute a fair game for everybody. And I, you know, the analogy holds up for society. We want it to be fair. We want everyone to sort of understand what has transpired in a particular situation. And we want to get away from the disinformation from the loudest people who are just out there, you know, really misinforming, and they're good at it and they're loud. And suddenly, you know, you're tipping people's opinions despite the fact that there may be no truth to it at all.
Yeah. And your point that some officials may not like that there are cameras, I can't believe that almost every cop would not want this, because I do believe that the overwhelming majority of cops are good. And
absolutely,
when they get accused of some misbehavior, I think they absolutely would want it to be shown. Here's what I did. I did not do what I was alleged. And the flip side, those good cops that I believe are the overwhelming majority, if there is a bad one among them, I think they don't want to have to go to bat against that cop because of the brotherhood. But if there's now video, they don't have to, and they could still purge that cop out of their ranks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it doesn't, much to your point, it doesn't require now them all, you know, being in the same station house and creating some, you know, infighting, negative attitudes and all that stuff. It's like, no, we've got evidence that this officer is not, you know, not following the rules, not playing by the rule book. And we don't need his partner to come forward and rat him out, if you will, and then create a dangerous or a real negative situation for him at work. So, you know, cameras are a part of our life. They're everywhere. They're all over the place. We all just have to get used to the fact that, you know, if you're going to be out in public, you need to be on your best behavior, because there's likely a videotape of it somewhere.
So I don't know that I'm with Mike Nabors. I don't know if we want to get into the whole thing about whether the Stony Creek situation is good or bad. That's been debated and discussed and all the rest. But I do want to ask you about the idea of strong mayor powers and whether you think this is a good thing that a mayor has this extra oomph behind him or her to flex a muscle and push something through if council gets bogged down, or if you are nervous about the idea of a mayor having those kind of powers.
Well, what do you think, Scott? Are you and I going to agree or disagree on this one? I don't know.
Well, I mean, where do you go on it?
You know what? So I'm all for it. I'm all for strong mayor powers. I think, first of all, make you think twice about who you vote for mayor in the future. But I like it. I like it. And the reason I like it is because, I've always felt, and I worked for a while, I do Hammer Down with Jason Farr, and I worked in his office, when he was a city councilor, and I, you know, got some up close look at how local government works. And I just really feel like we needed a stronger voice for the city as a whole. And yeah, you know what? I mean, with it is going to come, there's going to be some decision. You're going to go, I don't like it. I don't like that decision. But I like the idea that we strengthen the mayor, and it's not just one vote. The city as a whole gets one vote. That's the exact same as every councilor trying to protect their fiefdom. And so I think strong mayor powers could be a very useful tool, as long as it's not overplayed. And like any power, you know, that's to be determined in the future. So,
I do like your suggestion, which I had thought before and then forgotten about. So I'm glad you raised it. I do like your suggestion that strong mayor powers may be a motivation for more people to get out to municipal ballot boxes on election day, because heaven knows it's usually a pathetic turnout. And if we now believe that the person you're voting for has that kind of power, maybe more people say, I'm going to have a say in that. That I do like.
Yep.
The part about it, though, so here's where I think the strong mayor powers become difficult. I think when and we'll use this example, when Andrea Horvath used the strong mayor powers here in Stony Creek, I believe she essentially locked herself in that when any other suggestion is going to come up by any other councillor in any other part of the city, that she almost has to now use those strong mayor powers, or else it looks like favoritism is being granted, and not every case is exactly the same. I think it complicates things an awful lot for local politics, because you know what? There's going to be people pointing at this now saying, well, what about downtown Hamilton? What about Ancaster? What about Dundas? Why are they not having to have these things? And if a situation arises where she could use her strong mayor powers and doesn't, I think it really makes some complications.
I would agree. It's not, you know, it's not a silver bullet answer to any problem. My concern is always just not moving, just being stuck in the mud forever. I mean, you know, literally, I swear to God, Scott, we could watch this council, this property in Stony Creek, this thing could come up for debate 19 times. We could be dealing with this 12 years from now. I mean, and that's the problem, is that these things get stuck in the mud, and if you don't have somebody just really, you know, giving the buggy a push, you're not getting out of that mud. And I think I like the mayor still can be held accountable. We're still going to hold them accountable at the ballot box the next time around. You know, there's it's still a democracy. But at the end of the day, she's going to have to put her record forward and say, here are the times I used my strong mayor powers when I felt it was in for the benefit of the city. And you're going to judge me on that. But I'm okay with that. I'm okay with us. We're going to take a couple of hits along with maybe some good things happening. But I nothing infuriates me more than government in action. And that's what we got bogged down on this one, and it just became inactive, right?
It would have been a fascinating thing to see strong mayor powers, for better or for worse, and people can, you know, the audience that we're talking to today is going to be on both sides of this one.
Sure.
If Fred Eisenberger had had strong mayor powers during the LRT debate,
yeah,
how that would have changed something. And when I say change something, I mean, I wrote something this week about what if we had just had a referendum like so many people wanted, and it would have either made, if the thing passed for the LRT, those councillors who were opposed would have kind of had to get out of the way and we could have had progress on this. And if it failed, those people who were for it would have had to say, the people don't want it, I'm going to get out. Either way, we would have had clarity. We might have had more clarity if Fred Eisenberger had had strong mayor powers on this thing. Now, the flip side is he may, I don't know, he may have been voted out because he used the strong mayor powers, which would have unclarified it again. I don't know. But it would have been fascinating to see how that would have worked at that time.
I would go back beyond Fred Eisenberger. It's the other thing you were talking about there, which is a referendum. And we see this in the states all the time. All kinds of states put all kinds of things on their ballot. And I love this idea. I just don't know why we're so reticent in Canada to not say, hey, let's let everyone chip in on this one. Let's say, you know, what on the big issues, you know, and they, you know, well, we elect the leaders to lead. Well, no, we don't. You know, we do elect them to lead, but they don't do a very good job of it. The big issues before us, every time we come up to an election, twice if you want to do one mid-election, let's vote on some of this stuff and let's see what the people of Hamilton. And, you know, it turnout's lousy and it doesn't matter, whatever. It's a democracy.
It's a really interesting point because I wrote about this week in The Spectator saying, what would have just happened if we had a referendum way back once upon a time for clarity? And I'll tell you, many, 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 many comments, both on the attached to the column, Twitter message to me, and those in favor said, yes, we absolutely should have had a referendum. This is too controversial, too big an issue not to. But there were a lot of people too, Mike, that said, we elect our representatives to make these kinds of decisions. It's bad politics to go to the people and ask them because it simplifies complicated issues and we don't get good decisions. What do you say to that last one? Because I know what you say to the first one. What do you say to the latter one?
Well, so first, let me say, I wish I'd read the piece. I should have done my research before I came on. I love reading your stuff, Scott, and you always have a great take. And it's a take that, you know, it stirs people up. And I love that, man. I mean, that's what this is all about, right? It's debating ideas in a public forum. And so I wish I'd read your piece. I'm going to go read it after we're done the show tonight. What I would say to that is, this is kind of big picture Mike's version of things, but once upon a time, Scott, we created a democracy. Okay. And all the people in this little village elected a person, and that person went to Ottawa or went to whatever capital to represent those people and what those people, or at least the majority of those people, wanted. And then we got into party politics, and that's where I think, you know, we can't undo party politics, but that's where so much of this stuff just gets grinded into pulp mash. And so I think my gal, I elect that person, and then they go, and then a party whip tells them how they have to vote, regardless of whether it's good for the little town they're representing or not. They got to go with the party. That's where I have a real problem with how our system functions right now. And so I would say one way to override that a little bit is to put out a referendum on really big ticket items. Like, I don't know what, you know, the Highway 413 would be a great example. Do Ontarians want us to spend X billion dollars building Highway 413? I'd love to know, you know, whether that was the final decision, or at least that goes into the final decision when the government does have the power to say yay or nay. I still would love to know, and not a poll, because polls, we know, cannot capture the full veracity of the populace. So I want to know, do Ontarians want to spend that $1 billion on the 413? I want to know if Hamiltonians, the majority of Hamiltonians, want LRT, and live or die by the results.
It's Okay, a couple things on that, and no. I mean, look, I agree. Generally, I agree with the concept of referendums, and generally, it's my belief, rightly or wrongly, that those who oppose them are opposing them because they're worried they're going to lose. You don't ever oppose right. them if you think you're on the good side. So that's the first one. The right. second one is the comment that says we elect our officials to make these very complicated decisions because a referendum is a very simplified decision that doesn't capture everything. Well, we elect people by simply putting an X next to their name in the box. We have no idea how educated or not you are when choosing that person. You could choose them because they look nice. You could choose them because they're first alphabetically. You could choose them because any number of reasons.
That's who your parents voted for.
Any yeah. number of reasons. And so the idea that somehow we give all this thought and education and study to choosing our representative, but we wouldn't give any to the issue on a referendum, I think is ludicrous. I think more people would give more attention to the issue in a referendum than they do. I can assure you that there are probably 80% of people in this city who do vote in a municipal election who do not have one clue who they're voting for in the school board running, for example. They don't have right. a clue. They see a name. Right. Oh, looks good. I've heard that name before. I will do that.
Yep.
So the idea that somehow we are rubes and we don't know the ins and outs.
We can't handle it. We can't handle the truth.
We don't have all the details. Therefore, we shouldn't have a yes or no thing. To me, we do that already with voting who we vote for.
That's right. You can't say we can't have referendums because the population is ignorant and then say, oh, but by the way, that same population is going to vote for who gets to vote, whether we exactly. do something or not. So exactly. that's kind of a ridiculous concept. I do get the idea that you know, there are things that have been presented and the misinformation, especially that goes on with some things. But when it comes down to a basic concept, you know, that here, you know, you can spell out, you can lay out very succinctly what the LRT is going to be, how it is going to service the area. I mean, I don't live anywhere near the LRT. I would likely never ride the LRT. And yet I have always supported the LRT as a city building project, as a project to make this city look better and look more modern and look like we're growing. And I think that you get a lot of oomph from that. So you know, so I have a different set of reasons for wanting the LRT than somebody else, or somebody who doesn't want the LRT. So but to say that we're, you know, I mean, we can't quite figure it out. Well, you know what? I can figure out how much it's going to cost, and you could tell me how much it's going to cost and what the timeline's going to be and what you believe the economic spinoff is going to be. And I think I can make a pretty fair decision yep. over whether I want my tax dollars spent on that or not.
It is, it's an interesting one. It really is. It's, I think we could handle it. And I think it would be I don't think we want to have a referendum on every stop sign that goes
absolutely
in,
not.
But on the biggest of the giant issues, I do think, and we got to go, but you mentioned one other thing that I think is absolutely true about this. You mentioned about how certain things could draw more people out to vote. I think
absolutely.
A referendum on the LRT would have absolutely jacked up the number of people who voted in the municipal election. Absolutely
and then,
would have.
And likewise, they would have jumped on and then they would have been there. So they would have voted for the rest
That's
of the
thing. Exactly.
And you see that in California all the time. They do referendums all the time and they get all kinds of people coming. You know, everybody's whether to make marijuana legal or not. That got millions of people out to vote.
It would bring people to the polls. It really would.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
The man who, I don't know if he's got his trucker license yet. I know he was working on it. His name is Mike Neighbors. How is the trucking going?
You know what? I have my license. I have an AZ license now, so I can drive a tractor trailer.
To Arizona? Is that what that means? You can drive it only to Arizona?
AZ. Yeah. I am not driving a truck to make a living right now. I have another job, which I can't speak of. So it's a government-related job, and I'm not allowed to speak
in
media.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, like, erotic male performer or something, so you couldn't talk about it.
I wish it was that interesting, Scott. It's not that interesting. But I've put the license to good use at this job, so it's all worked out in the long run. And as far as your quiz question is concerned, I can't fathom an idea for what that would be. So
I would not know that one.
I wouldn't know it.
But, you know, I mentioned off the top, and again, people who are listening, even if they don't know your name, and I don't know how many people wouldn't know your name, but even if they didn't, they hear your voice and it's very familiar because they've been to Ticat games and they hear you on the PA system and doing your stuff. And we are like 2.5 weeks away from 2 weeks, I guess, away from training camp opening. And then we're into preseason games. And then the season
May 25th.
Is on. Yep.
May 25th is the first preseason game. Yeah.
Do you have to do anything to get ready for the season, or do you just show up and scream names into the microphone?
You know what? It's funny you say that because, you know, for the longest time I worked in radio and I did the Ticats. This will be my 14th season as the stadium announcer for the Ticats, and I love it. So yeah, my absolute favorite thing to do in the world. So other than spending time with my girls, and it's funny because I didn't realize sort of how much I, you know, I was using my voice every day at work and as a radio host, and then I would do the games and everything was just fine. Well, over the last couple of years, I haven't been working in radio, and now suddenly it's my voice is starting to break down by the end of a game, because it's like any other kind of muscle, right? It's not being worked during the week like it used to be. I used to be, you know, a lot of announcing, and I'd read commercials, and I'd do all kinds of so I don't do anything particular other than take care of it on the day of the game. I just try, you know, not to exert it too much because I will be exerting it for about 4 hours. And by the end of the 4 hours, it's pretty ragtag. I couldn't do a back-to-back. It's a good thing I don't do baseball.
See, I thought it would be the opposite because you always hear, well, not always, you occasionally hear about singers, for example, who they don't use their voice away from the stage because they say, I don't want to use it up. So you're saying you got to use it to get it in shape. And they're saying, I don't want to use it except when I sing.
So when I was using it on a daily basis, and then it wasn't much of a strain, but now that I don't use it on a daily basis, it is a strain to call a game. So yeah, so what I do is kind of what a singer does, which is I just kind of protect it that day, make sure I'm not talking too much, make sure I'm not using the vocal cords too much, and then I can get through a game. But by the end of a game, yeah, I'm running out of gas. By the time we got done the Grey Cup game, because there was a lot of stuff going on, you know, it was pretty spent, and it was, you know, gets, and I can tell, you probably can't tell in the stands. I can tell it just starts to crack. I can't quite hold the, you know, the, make some noise. I can't hold that as long. I could feel it. So I protect it, and I absolutely adore the job. I adore the being at the games, the atmosphere. It's the one of the greatest, you know, it's one of the best things that happens in Hamilton 11 times a year and you know, 12, 13, if we're real lucky. And I just love to be a part of it. It's just an amazing experience.
One of the things you have to do, or you're expected to do, is when whatever play happens on the field, whoever the player is who's involved, you are the one saying, you know, first down, 8 yard pickup by so-and-so or tackle by so-and-so. Do you have to, almost like a play-by-play announcer, know those players, or are you being fed that by a spotter?
You're trying to pull the curtain back on my routine.
100%.
I actually have a guy who I work with named Gus, and Gus, I inherited Gus in the job. Gus was an old friend of Jason Farr's, and of course, Jason did the stadium announcing before me, and so Gus came with the position, and Gus is a spotter. Knows CFL rules inside and out. The other people who work, the CFL officials, have come down to ask him questions. And so Gus feeds me everything. So it's kind of like, I mean, if you remember the movie we were talking about earlier about cultural references, but the movie Broadcast News, and, you know, the anchor was just kind of a dumb stuff shirt. And that's, you know, Gus likes to portray me as just the dumb stuff shirt who just says what Gus tells him to say. But it really is what's happening, because I have to balance off reading the commercials during the breaks, I'm taking cues from the producer over, you know, when to go, when to say things, when not to say things. And so Gus really is the guy who gets me the information on every play, tells me how many yards were gained, tells me who was carrying it, tells me who the tackler was. And then I spout that. And we've got such a great rapport doing it for 14 years that I think people come into the booth and are sometimes quite amazed that as Gus is saying things, I'm announcing it, you know, sort of I can hear in one ear and it comes out my mouth. It's really quite interesting to watch.
The other thing, though, that is difficult, I would think, is that it's one of the things the CFL, I think, has tried to get away from a little bit, but it is a league that is a bit of a Bedouin league. There are a lot of guys that move around from team to team every year. And so there's a lot of new players that at the start of every year, you have not announced their names before, and not all of them are Bob Smith. And so how much time do you have to spend, or do you, practicing the proper pronunciation of guys' names?
You know what? Again, I'm going to go back to my man, Gus, because Gus actually goes, the CFL has a pronunciation guide. And so Gus goes through the guide, gets the pronunciations all down. And so he feeds me the pronunciations as we need them. It's funny because we do point out sometimes we'll be looking at the game sheets and we don't really announce much of the opposing team's defense. We don't announce the tacklers for the opposing team. We just talk about the Ticats. And so he'll point out a couple of names because they will only come up if the person gets hurt. And a couple of times it's been a situation where he's pointed out a name. I go, oh, I hope that guy doesn't get hurt. And sure enough, if you say it, dude's getting hurt and I'm going to have to go. And some of those names, yeah, they can be tricky. But
even if they're on the pronunciation guide, sometimes if you have not practiced, even when you get it plopped in front of your face and it's phonetic, if you got to say it to a crowd on the spur of the moment, it's still not the easiest thing to do.
It's not. And I you know, I'm going to mess his name up now, but there was a player, he played with BC, Solomon Aluminium.
Yeah.
Solomon Aluminium, and we had him, and he was one of our guys. BC was playing us, and we pegged him. We went, oh, that's a tough, because it really, especially when you see it written out, it does not flow like you and I just flowed it. And he got hurt, and he wasn't. It was earlier in his career. He wasn't maybe as well known because he actually had a really good career and became, you know, a little better known. But I remember, and I went on, and we still laugh about it because I went on and I said, you know, the injured BC Lion is, and I just, as I saw him, and that's literally what I said. It was horrible. And we still laugh about this, that horrible pronunciation of poor. This poor guy's hurt on the field, and all he hears is, Sobla-oblibidim.
Well, and I just led you astray again, because this is the problem I've had with his name, which is part of the reason that it's a perfect example, because aluminium is, of course, aluminum in like British. Aluminium is his last name. I've done that so many times over the years with his name. But
that's the guy. Anyway, we all know who the guy is now.
If you actually want to see something really funny one time, go back, get the old DVD set for the 1972 Canada-Russia Summit Series, the hockey. And of course, back when this happened, Foster Hewitt was brought out of retirement to do it because it was such a big event. And Canadians, by and large, really did not have a lot of exposure at that time to Russian names. We just didn't, other than maybe the odd leader of the Soviet Union or something.
Yeah.
And if you go back and listen, it is hysterical. There is, for example, the name Valery Harlamov was Harlamov, Karlamov, Karlamov, Karlamamov. It's probably said seven different ways. And Foster Hewitt was the best of his era, best of all time. And all these Russian names were different every single time he said it.
Oh, that's awesome.
But it's a hard thing to do. Who was your, we were, you know, earlier this week, yesterday, Bob Cole died. Legendary NHL play-by-play guy. Who's your Bob Cole, or maybe it is Bob Cole, but who's the guy that sport, whatever sport it is, that was your favorite? Who's the play-by-play person that it is just music to your ears when that person does or did their thing?
Yeah, you know what? That's an interesting question. I don't know that I was always more the color guy like that, you know, so the play-by-play guys were great, but I was always far more interested in the color guys. And And you'll remember, Scott, I mean, we're both, you know, relatively of the same age. I don't know anybody who could have watched Howard Cosell on Monday Night Football and not been impressed by what. So it was. It's people like that. Howie Meeker. I used to love Howie Meeker on Hockey Night in Canada. Don Cherry. I mean, those the entertaining guys who commented around sports were always more dear to my heart. I didn't really peg any specific sort of play-by-play announcer as somebody who I grew up listening to. It was really more the color guys around them who I always sort of was drawn to.
I have a couple nods that I want to throw out here, and one of them is very recent. One of them, I've only begun to really appreciate what he does recently, and that is, and it's very specific, is Jim Nantz at the Masters. It is the perfect voice and perfect delivery for that particular tournament. If the Masters did not exist, I don't know that I ever point to Jim Nantz as the golf announcer that I would say is among my favorites. There is something perfect about that voice at that place with those visuals that just works. But the other one, just because of us being around here and everything that happened, Tom Cheek with the Blue Jays, and maybe it all goes to the Joe Carter, touch them all. I don't know, but it's hard not to. There's so many memories, and that was, don't forget, that was still, amazingly enough, because, you know, it doesn't seem like it can be that long ago. That was still a time when I would still at times be listening to the Blue Jays on transistor radio. Once in a while you're out in the backyard or something. And it seems like that is so, we talked about before, antiquated. So how we show our age, it's not that long ago that was a thing people did.
I saw there was a meme, and it just captured sort of how I see the world. But the meme was, the person said, you know, somebody the other day said something happened 30 years ago, and I'm thinking, oh, the mid-70s? And they're going, no, the mid-90s.
Yeah.
And it's like, right? 30 years ago to me is the mid-70s.
Yeah, and people still listen to the radio. Obviously, we're talking on it right now, but it's digested so differently. It's on your phone now, or in your car, or on your computer. It would be a rarity to walk by some guy's backyard and he's got an old transistor radio that's playing. There are some out there still, but it's just, it's different how you do it.
And it's also, and I think when you're talking about the voices of sports and stuff like that, and maybe Jim Nantz and the Masters is a great example, because the Masters is such a unique thing and Jim Nantz's voice matches it so beautifully. I think in a lot of other cases, a lot of young people growing up today aren't going to have the same connection that we had with a Bob Cole or with a Foster Hewitt, because it's all so splintered. You know, the hockey's changing. It's on a different channel. It's on a different radio broadcast. There's different people covering. So you don't sort of have it, you know, back in our day, Scott, it was one voice, and that was the only voice you got. If you wanted to hear the game, you got that voice. And now it does seem more splintered, and you can hear it in lots of different formats, right?
If you go back for people who have grown up in Hamilton and their experience was growing up with the Ticats and listening on the radio, you had talked about that. I mean, for the longest time, it was Bob Bertina or it was Norm Marshall, or like there were these long stretches where it was the same voice. And then all of a sudden, you know, we had Rick Zamperin do it for a bunch of years right here on CHML. Fantastic job. And then there was, you know, on a different station, there was Andy McNamara and Marshall Ferguson and RJ Broadhead. And there's nobody, I don't think, today that would say that would have that sentiment where for my childhood or for my teenage, for some long stretch, that was the voice of the team. It's almost a, well, I tune in and whoever's on now I listen to, but it doesn't really matter now, which is
a lot more change, changeover and stuff. Yeah, it is unfortunate, especially with the relationship we developed with that person who took us along on that journey, right? I mean,
great
color person, the play-by-play person, describing it. But it's also a little bit of what radio did so well. And now, you know, you've got the visuals right in front of you. You don't necessarily need somebody describing it. Some sports lent themselves to radio really well. And then you developed a relationship with that narrator and that narrator, you know, brought the thing to life for you. So, but that is, it's an art form that, you know, for the most part, I think is kind of going to the wayside.
I love that word, though, that you've used twice there, relationship, because I really, the best ones, you do have a relationship. And I mentioned Tom Cheek, like Tom and Jerry, for the longest time, you would tune in. I can remember driving up to my grandmother's place in the Ottawa Valley at the start of the Blue Jay season for Easter weekend, and we had it on in the car. And it was just, you just drove along and you listened, and they were familiar and they were comfortable, and you did. You had a relationship. And then if you ever met any of these people, it's like you already knew them.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And they, because they, you know, they're right there in the car with you. It's, yep. It was such a weird feeling, but they were in the car with you. And like you said, I think it's the comfort that comes with it. A great narrator, telling you a story, and that's really what they're doing. And yeah, it's, but as an art form, you know, unfortunately, the video age kind of has taken over, and now the kid can sit in the back seat and just, you know, watch it on YouTube or whatever. So it's changed. Things have changed. I'm never against change, but we lose some things along the way.
We do. The ability of people, the best of them, to paint a picture with their words and have you right there with your eyes closed is something that was very special, and I think it's becoming less and less, as you say. But I tell you what,
on the other hand, you know what? There's people, Scott, and you know, and I'm sure you hear from some of them, but unfortunately, we don't hear from enough of them to always know the impact we're having. But there are people who every single night they listen to Scott Radley. Whoever your guest is, whoever's going, I mean, you've become part of their ritual. Maybe it's because they drive to work every night from 7 to 8, or whatever it is, whatever that ritual is. You become that passenger in the car with them, and you tell a story every night and discuss the issues of the day, whatever it is you're doing. But that relationship is it's a unique one. And once in a while, I'm sure it's happened to you. You meet somebody and you go, wow, like I didn't realize sort of the impact. You know, I just come in and do what I think is interesting. But people go, wow, you know, I woke up every day with you, or every afternoon, I used to love when you used to do this, or well, whatever. And you go, wow, you have an impact in this job. It's really
it
cool
is.
Thing.
Yeah, no, it's something that honestly, I never think of that. And you know, but I suppose you're right. I would be very honored if that was the case and people felt that way, but it's something I never, you know, because here's the thing. And like, I don't want to be ridiculous here. All those people that I talked about before, you never think of yourself as one of those people, and I'm not, but yeah, it's an interesting,
or think of yourself as having the impact they had on you. But again, it's a voice. And with regularity, they get to know that voice. They get to know that person.
Yeah,
and they start
no,
to think
right.
of that person as a friend. And you know, we used to say, when I worked in radio for a long, long time, there used to be this old adage that when you had a morning show host, that for the first 5 years you had a morning show host, the radio station was bigger than the morning show host. After 5 years, the morning show host was bigger than the radio brand.
Yep, like,
because people had developed a relationship with that person, and now changing that person became a much more difficult thing to do. You were taking a bigger risk because now the audience had a relationship with that person, and it wasn't just a relationship with your radio station.
Mike, there was a really interesting press conference on Thursday with the Prime Minister and the Premier of Ontario, and they were talking about a new Honda EV plant and how there was going to be $5 billion of public funds that were going to be involved in this. And they were asked, and it got very contentious at one point, but they were asked about jobs, how many jobs? And the Prime Minister said, there's going to be 1,000 jobs that are going to be created. Now, 1,000 jobs is a wonderful thing at any time. But if you're talking about $5 billion of public funds for 1,000 jobs, that's $5 million per job. Now, jobs are great. Jobs are important. How much is a job worth?
That's a tough one, Scott. Yeah, that's a lot of money to employ 1,000 people. I guess, yeah, you know, specific, you know, I don't know the absolute details of this specific one. But I'm guessing what we're the hope there is that you invest the $5 billion, you get the 1,000 jobs, but then you get tons of spinoff off of it as well, right?
That would be, I'm sure that's the hope.
Yeah. I mean, they're using our nickel. We get some more nickel miners. So have they extrapolated jobs out throughout what that means? I know Honda already, is employing half of Alliston. So you're also, you're also investing a little bit to keep them here, keep them happy. I mean, there's a lot of things going into it. I'm a little more concerned about all this money going into EVs and nobody wants to buy them. That concerns me a little more than what we're spending on building battery plants, but.
Yeah, the question with this, and I believe wholeheartedly that there is value in having people work. It gives you value in your life. It gives you meaning.
Sure.
It allows you to feel like you're providing for your family. But all those things, they absolutely have a value, and they have a monetary value. I have a hard time wrapping my head around the fact that we have to spend $5 million of public funds per job to employ someone. I mean, if we were going to do that, have a whole bunch of people clean up garbage out of the downtown streets or whatever, and pay them $100,000 each. There's 50 people you could employ for the price of one, and they would be well compensated.
Right. You're not wrong. When government gets into, sort of spending money, they do it in such large quantities that we sometimes have problems even wrapping our heads around what that really means. When you start using billions, it's funny because I keep going back to an interesting way for me at least to comprehend the difference between a million and a billion. And it was a million seconds ago was 10 days ago. And a billion seconds ago was 31 years ago. So that really helps you put into context the difference between your million and your billion. And when they're talking about $5 billion, I mean, it's just such a sum of money. And they you get 1,000 jobs. Okay. Well, like you just said, that's $5 million a job. That doesn't seem right. You also are going, what else is there? What's in the fine details? What is Honda getting out of this besides just the $5 billion? Like, it's just, they're very complicated issues, Scott, which is why we should not have a referendum on.
Yeah. I do love I do love your explanation though, because I really believe that we have completely over the last 4 or 5 years lost any kind of semblance of grasp of how much money is being spent, because during COVID with CERB and everything else, that money just flying out every left, right, and center.
Yeah.
Your example is really important because we now hear about $5 billion and it's like, $5 billion, it's nothing. Yeah. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money that taxpayers have to pay for. And we
so much money.
When we've got deficits of 50 or 60 billion and debts of 1.5 almost trillion, a $5 billion sounds like it's just something you blow your nose into a Kleenex and there you go. There's five. I mean, it's like nothing. It's nothing. And it's a huge amount of money still.
Well, and I'm starting to hear, I have conversations with lots of different people and I'm getting a little discouraged at sort of more and more people who are sort of laughing off the debt or the deficit. And they're just kind of, it's play money. It doesn't mean anything. Well, no, it does mean something. Deficits do mean something, and owing this money does mean something, because every time, they create a new budget, it's like, well, the first $68 billion comes off of our tax dollars just to go service the debt. Like that's the part where we don't get into the weeds on that enough with people to have them understand that we need to reel in our governments when it comes to spending, because that debt can't just keep growing. It's zapping us of our ability to create jobs here at home without investing $5 billion with Honda.
I'm just doing some math as we're talking here, because using your example of 31 years, It's almost 32 years, by the way, is
Yeah.
a billion seconds.
Yeah.
You know what? My calculator won't even show the number, because if using a billion, we're giving 54, we're spending $54 billion a year just to service our debt.
Yeah.
That's money we're just giving to the banks, giving to the borrowers.
Yep.
That's doing
Yep.
nothing. I tried to type in 32 million times 54. it is incomparable. My computer doesn't handle those kind of numbers.
Into the cartoon numbers, right?
It just means nothing.
Yeah.
It means nothing anymore. It's
trazillion.
Trazillion. Yeah, we're going to make up quintrazillion. We were just chatting about money and jobs and public dollars and huge amounts of money. Well, we're not going to talk about that huge an amount of money, Mike, but let's bring it a little closer to us, because there was a story in the Spec this week by Nicole O'Reilly, the great reporter, and it's a complicated story. There's no question. So we're not going to get into all the details, because there's extra stuff beyond what we need to talk about here. But essentially, the underlying part of this story is it's about a guy who won $1 million in the lottery, which is a lot of money, not as big as lottery wins we've seen, but a lot of money. He says it was the worst thing that ever happened to him. And we've heard this story, Mike, before from people who say, you know what, winning the lottery was fantastic when I won, and then the trouble came. And in retrospect, yeah, the money was fantastic, but I don't know if I would want this to happen again. We've heard that many, many, many times. Not every lottery winner, of course, but we've heard it many times.
Yeah.
I know the initial knee-jerk answer, if I said to you, would you want to win a lot of money in a lottery, is obviously going to be yes. We all would say yes. But when you stop and really think about it, do you think you would really want to win $10 million in a lottery?
Sure. Yeah. I've heard the stories, and I know a fellow personally who won $1 million in, I forget what it was now. It was like the Princess Margaret or something. And him and his wife won $1 million. And the ruin that came to them in a very short order after that was quite amazing to witness. And you know what? Some of it was them not being able to handle it. Some of it was people turning on them. It was like crazy stuff. Like family upset that their Christmas gifts weren't bigger because you won $1 million. Like really crazy stuff. And you kind of go, wow, I never would have thought any of that would happen. And they ended up splitting up. They got divorced. It all kind of went sideways. You could blame the money. You could have said that might have still happened, whatever. But definitely the money played a role in unraveling their relationship to some degree. And so then you ask me the question, would I still... And here's my plan. It's always been my plan. I don't play the lottery. My dad does. I figure if I'm supposed to win money, my dad will. But I always thought to myself, say I won $10 million, what I would do is the infighting in his family was the part that really caught me off guard. And so I thought, I'll publish a list and I will give it to all family members, and it will show, you know, my brother and my wife's brother, you each get, you know, 50,000. And then on down the list, right? So that everybody knows what they got. Everybody knows how much they got, all ranked in order according to how close you are in my family. And hopefully that might dispel some of it. But Scott, it brings the world of hurt to these people, and they're not prepared for it.
And again, I know that everybody listening, when I ask this question, is probably saying to himself, that is the dumbest question you could possibly ask.
Dumb.
Of course I would take $10 million. Who would not? If you were walking down the street and you stumbled. See, here's the thing. If you were walking down the street and you found $10 million and you gave it to the police, because that's what an honest person would do, and nobody claimed it and they said you can have it, very different story, because it is not announced to the world that you now
yep.
possess this money, unlike a lottery win. Right. It's not
yeah.
about it's not about having the money. It's about having the notoriety of having the money, which I think is what really causes a lot of these problems.
It absolutely did. And for my friend who just lived around the corner from me, he you know, and he wasn't like a close friend. He was just an acquaintance of mine, but I just sort of watched all this happen. And because they, it was again publicly announced, it was part of the, I believe it was the Princess Margaret, it could have been something else, but they won this $1 million and everybody knew it. And they were seized upon immediately. I mean, the first thing they had within 3 days of the announcement of them winning the money, they had to change their phone number. And the phone was just ringing constantly from all over the world. People were calling, you know, giving some sad stories. Oh, you've got to help me. My mom is dying and we can't afford to buy the kidney. What, like, it was just crazy stuff. And then people started showing up at their door, just randomly knocking at their door. Like they were under siege. And that was, you know, $1 million, like you said at the top, $1 million. That's a lot of money in other retrospects, it's not a lot. Our house, you know, most people who are lucky enough to own a house, it's probably getting close to being worth $1 million. So, you know, at the end of the day, you go, it wasn't so much money that you go, they could just part with it. But there are a lot of people out there who that's what they spend their time doing, targeting these people, trying to figure out a way to free them up of some of their cash. It was his own family and the struggles he had with his family that I found really kind of shocking.
Yeah, I really believe that it's a much more complicated thing to deal with this guy. And I've not ever been in that position. I've not won a lottery, but I think it's a much more complicated thing to win a lottery than we portray. That, you know, what's that commercial about, you know, you can, I don't know what it is, but
just
like
live
do whatever.
Your dreams.
And, yeah, yeah, live all that kind of stuff.
You don't dream big enough. And
exactly.
Kind of,
yeah, you know, your dream coach and all, and that's fine. Yeah. And for many people who win, it is absolutely wonderful and it is freeing and it is all those kind of things. I just, you know,
like everything in life, it comes with strings attached. Those strings can be, you know, things that you wouldn't have necessarily thought of, but it's going to come with strings attached and it's going to impact relationships.
Is.
Whether you like it or not, how well you handle it.
Mike, we got to go, but how many people who are highly paid actors, actresses, celebrities, executives, athletes, whatever, they get paid a ton of dough, but they have things they have to do. They have to travel all the time. They have to work all the time. They have to be in the public eye. You get the money, but it doesn't come without any kind of, as you say, string attached. There's always some cost to having that money.
And they have agents and managers and
absolutely.
Accountants. And then you find out the accountant ripped you off and then you found out that the interpreter was betting your money. I mean, listen, there's all kinds of things going on out there. Scott, you and I are lucky enough not to have those problems.
That is true. Although if your dad wins, I know where to find you. that is Mike Nabors. Mike, hey, really appreciate you doing this today. Fantastic job. Always love having you on the show.
I appreciate being asked, Scott. You're always a great joy to sit and chat about the issues with. I love it, and I can't wait to come back and do it again real soon.
Hammer Down on Cable 14. You can see Mike there, and you will also hear his voice at Tim Hortons Field. Mike, thanks very much. We'll talk soon.
Stay safe, man.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.